This episode of Elevate is brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the trial attorney's ultimate consultative partner, providing time-saving expert resources at every step in the life cycle of a case. Wouldn't it be great if before moving forward with your next case, you could roundtable your theory with an expert in any subspecialty to make sure you're on solid footing before you invest money and time in the case? And you can do that without having to spend the money to formally retain an expert. Well, that's one of the services that Expert Institute offers. In fact, I just did that myself, had roundtabled a new case with a group of doctors at Expert Institute. We concluded that it was probably a good case, and then they helped me find the expert that I needed to testify in the case. Expert Institute has on-staff doctors in almost every medical specialty who can consult with you about your case or even perform an in-depth record review and provide guidance on liability theories or how to maximize damages. Or you can connect with them before taking a technical deposition, perhaps of another side's expert, to help you develop a plan of attack and the most incisive line of questioning. For our listeners only, Expert Institute is offering 25% off your first expert case request. Go to expertinstitute.com/elevate, ELAWVATE, to redeem this exclusive discount. Welcome to the Elevate podcast. My name is Ben Gideon.
And my name is Rahul Ravipudi.
And we're really excited to introduce our new show, Elevate, ELAWVATE. And our first guest for our inaugural show is Rick Friedman. Rahul, you know Rick, right?
Yes, I do. And I'm always impressed by everything he has to say and the insight he shares, which he did amazingly today.
You know, when I first started trying cases, some of the first two books I picked up were Rick's books, Polarizing the Case and The Rules of the Road. It's basically must reading for trial lawyers. If you're trying cases and you haven't read those books, you're committing malpractice, in my opinion. So go out and buy them and read them or borrow them. I'll send you my copy if you need one.
Even if you're not trying cases, you've got to read those books so you can take effective depositions and frame your case from day one.
Things I've really appreciated about Rick are, you know, he is, many plaintiff's lawyers are kind of hard-charging types. Rick is that, but he's got an intellectual dimension. He's a Harvard graduate, and he really gives great, careful, and very thoughtful approaches to the work that we do. It's not just about the end result, but thinking through the whole process.
Yeah, and this most recent book, it's a constant reminder to all of us as lawyers that we need to be true to ourselves. And if we're not honest with ourselves, we can't be honest with the jury, and it's going to impact our clients.
So just a little bit more about Rick, and then we'll get right into it. Rick, as I mentioned, is a graduate of Harvard Law School. As you'll hear in the show, he began his legal career as a solo practitioner in Sitka, Alaska. And from there, he went on to practice law in Alaska, and now more recently in Washington State, Bremerton, and Seattle. He has some of the largest jury verdicts in the history of our country. In fact, in four separate years, he got verdicts that were in the top 10 verdicts anywhere in America. He's got two verdicts for over $100 million. And he's tried cases in a wide diversity of practice areas, including insurance, bad faith, personal injury cases. He's tried aviation cases. He's tried product liability cases. He's tried toxic tort cases. There's really almost no area of plaintiff's work that Rick Friedman hasn't made an impact. And probably more than that, he's been one of the preeminent teaching lawyers in the country for the last decade or more. He's written five books on trial practice, all of which have become bestsellers in the trial bar. And the most recent book, and the one we're going to focus on today, is hot off the presses. It was published within the last month or so. The title of the book is The Way of the Trial Lawyer Beyond Technique. And it's really focused on not just the nuts and bolts of being a lawyer, but all the intangible ways in which you need to improve in order to maximize your chances of success as a lawyer. So with that, let's move on and introduce our interview with Rick Friedman.
Welcome to the Elevate podcast, where lawyers learn, share, and grow to elevate their practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
We'd like to welcome Rick Friedman to the show today. We're so excited to have Rick as a guest. You've already heard a lot about Rick's accomplishments, but Rick is somebody I've greatly admired personally for many years. Anybody who is tries cases for a living has probably read one or more of Rick's books. But for those who don't inhabit the trial lawyer world or are new to the practice, Rick, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you went from graduating from Harvard Law School to being a solo practitioner in Sitka, Alaska, to achieving multiple $100 million verdicts, writing five books for trial lawyers, and being one of, I believe, one of the preeminent teachers of trial practice around?
Oh, thanks, Ben. The short answer to all of those questions, I guess, is that I couldn't get a job offer coming out of law school. So
even with Harvard?
Even with Harvard, yeah. So that will tell you what my academic record looks like. And yeah, I think I had a group of fellow students that we were going to go into practice together. And one by one, they all got job offers and decided not to go into practice with me. So of the four or five of us, one by one, they all got jobs. And so I decided to go back to Alaska, where I'd had a summer job in the DA's office. And yeah, so that's what I did.
So can you kind of take us forward from those humble beginnings where you couldn't find a job and you hung a shingle or started out on your own to, you know, you're now practicing in the state of Washington and Alaska and very other places all around the country. You've had these incredible verdicts, written all these books that have become part of the canon sort of trial practice literature. Take us through that career in broad strokes.
Well, there's a universe of facts there. I guess the reality, which is hard to for probably some of the younger listeners to understand, but when I went to Alaska, they didn't even have live TV. Anything we watched on TV was shipped up by barge on videotape, and we watched 2 or 3 weeks after it was aired in the lower 48. There were virtually no helpful books on how to practice law or how to try cases. CLE was not required. There was no internet. So there was an information void, and I guess the other factor going on was that I was in a sole practitioner or later a small practice where we did virtually everything that walked in the door. And I would try 3, 4, 5, 6 cases a year. One year I tried 13 cases in a year. So I was getting a lot of experience, and it was very diverse. But I had no one to really teach me how to practice law or how to win a trial. And so a lot of it was trial and error. And what went along with that was I would work hard to find any kind of article, book, videotape that might teach me how to be, you know, it wasn't like now where we're kind of being swamped in trial books and advice on how to do things. Back then, you know, if I could get Bill Barton's book on recovering for psychological injury, I felt like I'd scored a major victory. And then I would just, so I was reading everything I could, and I was pretty much self-taught. And that had its advantages and disadvantages.
So I'd really like to dig deep into the book you just published, which is the title of it is The Way of the Trial Lawyer Beyond Technique. I just finished the book. It was really a great book. And I felt like it spoke to me in a really personal way that I think you meant the book to try to connect with people who were interested in reading it. My first question for you is, though, that's the fifth book you've published. And it almost seems like a book that would take a number of decades before you could reach the insight, kind of in the understanding of what we're doing and as lawyers to write this book. So I'm kind of curious sort of what your personal development evolution process was that culminated in this book.
I began to notice and I'm talking, say, the first 5 to 10 years of practice, I began to notice that the best lawyer didn't always win. The most skilled lawyer didn't always win. The lawyer that works the hardest didn't always win. And the lawyer with the best facts didn't always win. And that sometimes it was apparent that something else was going on. And I couldn't put it into words, but I tried to pay attention to what it might be. And I would say the idea for this book first came to me maybe 20 years ago. Well, probably more like 30 years ago, as I was noticing that and thinking there is an intangible here. And I don't know how to put it into words, but it's definitely at work in the courtroom. And it's definitely outcome determinative at times. And that thing, that it, I just tried to pay attention to and figure out. And it, you know, it was a lot of just, as I tried cases, paying attention and trying to figure that out. And I don't know that I wouldn't say that my book is the final answer, but it's an attempt to point people in the right direction and an attempt to empower plaintiff lawyers, frankly, and criminal defense lawyers to pick up certain tools that I think have been mostly neglected by trial lawyers.
So if the most skilled lawyer or the best prepared lawyer doesn't always win or often doesn't win in the face of somebody who has this kind of it factor, what is your best thesis or understanding of what that it factor is? How would you describe what that is that allows someone who may be less skilled or less prepared to still nevertheless win?
Well, and again, just to be clear, I'm not saying you should be less prepared or that this is enough to get you by. And also not saying this is the only thing that results in the best lawyer not winning. I mean, there's luck, there's bad judges, there's all the usual things we talk about. But this is the thing I think we don't talk about. And, you know, as I mentioned in the book, Aristotle kind of broke down the major approaches to advocacy into three categories. There's logos or logic. We can appeal to the audience through logic. There's pathos. We can appeal to the audiences. He defined pathos, and it was understood as the things that are already residing in your audience. So, for example, if you have a tractor trailer case and some of the jurors have either been in tractor trailer collisions or one of their family members has, already residing in that audience is perhaps a prejudice against tractor trailers. So, if we think of, for example, the reptile approach, that's basically trying to figure out what's already in the audience and appealing to that.
And just so some listeners understand, the reptile is who you're alluding to.
Well, that's a book by Don Keenan and David Ball that talks about, you know, there's a lot to it, but essentially it's a discussion of how to take what's already, first, how to find out what's already residing in your audience, and then taking that and appealing to it in ways that are appropriate that can help you in trial. So that's pathos. And, you know, there are social scientists who will study juries and jury decision-making and tell you, you know, here's the demographic you want, or here, you know, you want people who listen to NPR or whatever their thing is. They're trying to figure out what's already in the jury. And then the third thing is what Aristotle called ethos, which for our purposes, there are a lot of different definitions, but for the way I have been thinking about it, it's the messenger, you know? So there are a lot of ways to talk about this, but who is this person who is trying to sell me a car, sell me on an injury, sell me that their client is not guilty? Who is this person and how much can I trust them and rely upon them? That's ethos, or the best I can get to describing it in a short sentence or two. But Aristotle thought that while, of course, you want to use all three of these approaches as best you can, he felt ethos was the most important. And we've all seen examples of that. For people of my generation, you know, you can think of the Jimmy Stewart movies where, you know, he plays some doofy guy from the Midwest who's elected to Congress and goes to Washington. And, you know, when he makes speeches, he kind of stumbles all over his words and he's inelegant, but people can feel how sincere and how much he believes in his position. And that overcomes all the other defects in his presentation.
What was one of the takeaways I had from the book was that you seem to feel like the lawyers are well-trained. They come out of law school with the ability to marshal logical arguments, or what you call logos, and that there's a lot of writing and teaching on how to appeal to a jury emotion or predispositions, which you've called pathos, but very little discussion nowadays on the importance of this third category you've described as ethos, which I think of because I was looking for synonyms, but maybe there isn't a perfect synonym, but authenticity or credibility or somebody who has maybe an earnestness that speaks from the heart. Those are all terms that I gleaned from the book, but none of them seem to be the perfect synonym. But do you feel like that's an area where, and maybe in fact, our culture and our legal system kind of pushes people away from having the qualities that would be defined as ethos?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we're talking about really big questions here and really big, really big questions that don't have a single answer. But yeah, I mean, as you know, in part of the book, and I don't want to be nostalgic, like when I started practicing, and even before then, from what I know of that time period, you know, things were, I would not want to go back to those times. But one distinct negative difference between those times and now is it really was regarded, being a trial lawyer was regarded as a profession back then. Like money was important, but secondary to doing a good job, helping clients. And I think the materialistic culture that we all live in has, you know, we all see how it's negatively impacted the medical profession on various other aspects of American life. But certainly in the plaintiff's bar, I have seen in my 41, 42 years, just a sea change in the attitude most lawyers have towards trying cases and practicing law. And it's not been good. It's, you know, we're now business people, not professionals. And so I don't want to get all sanctimonious about it, but I think in part that's made us less effective advocates. You know, what if the reason you're stepping into the courtroom is so you can make a ton of money, that's really different than I'm stepping into the courtroom because this case is about something bigger than myself and maybe even bigger than my client. And I'm here to advocate for these values. You know, I mean, just if you were to take that hypothetical, you know, do you want a lawyer stepping into the courtroom who's there because he's hoping to make a lot of money? Or do you want him to be there because he's going to advocate for values that are at stake that are important to you and to your recovery? And, you know, I don't think there's any question which is going to be the more effective advocate, with all other things being equal.
Rick, can you give us an example of ethos in practice?
Well, you know, and I mentioned this in the book, you know, Jerry Spence is fond of saying at CLEs, anybody in this room can beat me if they're just more authentic than me. I used to think that that was just more, you know, of Spence's hyperbole, but it you know, I think he sincerely believes it. And I think it's true that, so in practice, I mean, well, I can tell you a story. I'll try to make it short, but, back in the old days in Alaska, fish and game violations were almost an automatic not guilty verdict in these small fishing towns. And a friend of mine experienced trial lawyer was defending a fisherman charged with some sort of fishing violation. I can't even remember what it was. And he was just so happy. He'd got paid a lot of money. He was going to go defend this guy in the small town of Wrangell, Alaska. And the prosecutor on the other side, who was the most junior guy who I don't think had even tried a case before, or if he had, tried one or two. So my friend Cliff Smith was all excited. He was going to go have fun and kick this guy around the courtroom. And that's what he did. He kicked him around the courtroom the entire time. This poor young lawyer couldn't get anything done right. And Cliff was having a great time. This is as Cliff tells me the story. And he said, you know, I just got carried away. I was having so much fun and got so in love with my arguments. In my closing argument, I referred to the fish and game officers as being like Nazis and coming on board this ship like Nazis and doing this, that, and the other thing. And he said, this young prosecutor got up and stood in front of the jury and just started crying and said, "We're not Nazis. We're not Nazis," and sat down. And there was a conviction in like 5 minutes. That should have been a not guilty verdict 9 out of 10, 99 out of 100 times. But the ethos of this young prosecutor kind of brought everything back around to the right and wrong of the thing, and he managed to win. What part of the problem with your question, Raul, is that I shouldn't say problem, but it once again raises a lot of different issues, because one practical, very important part of having ethos in my mind is it gives the lawyer a certain stability in the courtroom. So if you're in there and the judge is browbeating you and being unfair, a bad day in court, things are going wrong. If you're there as a business person trying to make money, and again, I've got nothing against making money, but I'm saying if your primary compass is I'm there to make money and this judge is just beating the heck out of you, you're going to have a really bad day and you're going to start to panic and feel bad for various reasons. And if you're there for something bigger than yourself, if you're there, you know, I don't know, let's say it's an employment discrimination case and, you know, you're there on behalf of a Hispanic person who was wrongfully fired for racially motivated reasons, you know, if the judge is giving you a hard time, there's a certain steadiness that comes from the idea that I'm here fighting to see that people are treated fairly and equally in the workplace. And I may win or lose today's motion or today's trial, but that's not going to change who I am. I'm going to come back and fight for that value again and again and again. And it's a privilege to do that. And if we didn't, you know, if there wasn't prejudice against Hispanic people in the workplace, I wouldn't be needed. But as long as there is, I'm needed and I'm going to show up and I'm going to do this thing. That provides enormous steadiness, you know, if other things are dealt with, which I'm sure we're going to talk about a little bit in the, you know, if you, because there's two sides to this coin. There's one is the, what is the positive part of ethos that can kind of take you through those stormy days and those terrible situations? And then there's, what do I bring into the courtroom that defeats me myself, even when everybody's being great? But the first aspect to your question is getting centered in your own ethos in the appropriate way provides tremendous strength and stability and allows you to make better judgment calls in the heat of trial. So that's, I don't know if that answered your question, but that's about the best I can do.
And that's a great segue, because we've been really talking in theoretical terms up to this point, but actually most of your book is very practical in nature, and you make the point toward the end of the book that you know, a theoretical discussion of ethos is nice, but in the real world, you know, this really translates in the practicality of it. And so a lot of your teaching in the book is sort of a roadmap to lawyers that may be interested in cultivating or developing a better sense of ethos and courtroom ethos. Sort of how do you get there if you're not starting with that and you're trying to build that up? And I'd like to walk through kind of some of the things that you discuss in the book in a practical way. And so the first thing that I took from it was that the kind of step one involves some inward looking and kind of fixing problems within yourself, doing some amount of introspection and figuring a few things out that allow you to move to the next step. So can you kind of talk about the inward looking part of this process, the way you see it?
Yeah, well, I mean, the way I see it and the way I've watched it play out, both for myself and other people, is, you know, our personalities are formed by age 6, 7, or 8, and they're formed in response to the environment we're plopped into at birth. And so they make sense in the context of a 6, 7, or 8-year-old child. So, you know, if the only way I can get attention from my mother is making good jokes, I'll get really good at making jokes in all situations to get attention from my mother. If the only way I can avoid a beating from my father every Saturday night is to make myself really quiet and meek and submissive, then I'm going to develop a strong aspect of that in my personality. So that's all natural. It all makes sense. It doesn't mean your parents are bad people. You know, we all adapt to that environment we grow up in. And then, lo and behold, we graduate with a law degree and we're practicing law with personalities that were formed by 6, 7, and 8-year-olds or 0 to 8-year-olds. And we're no longer in an environment where we're totally dependent on our parents. And we have maladaptive behaviors, you know, things that don't fit anymore. So, you know, kind of the classic example is somebody who was mistreated by a parent, it doesn't matter which one, an abuse of authority by the parent, you know, and we can all imagine various abuses of authority by a parent. Now is in a courtroom, and the judge, the ultimate authority figure in the courtroom, starts to be abusive. That lawyer, if they have not dealt with the past and come to terms with it, and that's more than just intellectually saying, oh yeah, my father was a drunk and beat me, I'm over that. You know, it's way more complicated than that and more difficult than that. But if you haven't dealt with it, then what's going to happen is you're going to be responding partly to what the judge is doing, but to a large extent to what your parent did all those decades ago. You know, I frequently am in touch with lawyers who tell me they have an anger problem. You know, they lose their temper in the courtroom and they say, that's just how I am. That's just how I am. Well, but they recognize it's not helping them. It's hurting them. Well, the anger problem, where did that start? When did you first feel this kind of anger? Well, chances are it's age 6, 7. You know, if you walk them back, well, I remember a time in law school. You walk them back some more. Well, I remember a time in high school. You walk them back some more. And sooner or later, you wind up, oh, yeah, when I was 4 years old, I didn't do anything wrong, and this is what my parent did. And all of a sudden, you see the source of those things. And if you don't come to terms with them, they will sabotage you in the courtroom. And that's why, you know, some very hardworking, creative, intelligent lawyers, some of them, lose cases over and over and over again. Their ethos is out of whack, so to speak.
So I want to return to that in just a minute. But before we do that, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with more of Rick Friedman in just a minute. Our episode today is made possible by our friends at Expert Institute. Expert Institute helps you expand your firm's bandwidth without bumping up employee headcount. Since 2010, Expert Institute has partnered with over 4,000 law firms nationwide, connecting attorneys with top industry experts, providing medical case guidance from in-house physicians, and delivering case-winning insights from their team of multidisciplinary researchers. If you're listening to this podcast and you want to move your case forward with greater intelligence and strategic insight, go to expertinstitute.com/elevate, that's ELAWVATE, where you can redeem an exclusive 25% off discount available to our listeners. This will give you a great opportunity to test it out to see what Expert Institute can do for you. You could use this discount for an expert search, a case review, or a case theory roundtable, or even if you practice in mass torts, a mass tort preparatory support. Again, that's expertinstitute.com/elevate. We're back again now with Rick Friedman. So, Rick, when we left off, we were talking about some of the pathologies or kind of problems, defects that we all suffer from, whether we have a short fuse or tend to have other personality defects that interfere with our ability. We all probably want to succeed. We aspire to succeed. And as you have referenced, you know, many of us know why we don't. We see the problems, but a lot of people have a difficult time overcoming them and fixing them, and they end up falling prey to the same problem over and over again, despite best intentions. So,
I'm going to interrupt you though, too, Ben, because a lot of people don't see it. You know, that's the, if you see it, at least you've got a starting point. But a lot of people are in this place of self-denial. And, you know, I know all this because I've been in these places myself. So I'm not trying to say, you know, I'm somehow above this. I think I was able to write that book because I've experienced so much of this stuff myself. So I think a lot of people are in denial about their own shortcomings when it comes to ethos. For example, you know, for me, the hard part has been actually accessing my emotions as a trial lawyer. You know, one jury, I did a 6-week trial, and the jury had nicknames for all the lawyers. And the one they had for me was Flatline. And one of the jurors afterwards said, "We didn't even know you cared about the case until the closing argument. That's the first time we realized you might care about this case." So that's a piece of my problem, which I didn't even regard as a problem, frankly, for decades. But a part of myself was walled off. I didn't want to show the jury, and it made me less effective. Now, did I win cases? Yes, I did. Did I have success? Sure. But I wasn't all I could be as a trial lawyer, and I suspect if I had kind of gone down this route earlier, I would have had more success earlier.
And that tension that you just referenced between showing your emotion and being vulnerable with a jury is really opposite to what all the cues are that we're taught growing up, you know, through law school and in trial law, because you're taught never to show emotion, not to show weakness. So how do you balance that, this idea that you want to be perceived as the authority, really tough and, you know, knowledgeable, but also be vulnerable and be able to, you know, connect emotionally with a jury?
Well, I mean, it goes back to one of your earlier questions. I mean, the really first thing is you got to set your own internal house in order, because otherwise you're spending so much effort and energy kind of keeping this structure in place for yourself. You know, a lot of lawyers walk into the courtroom, and I was this way in my first trial. I don't think I wrote about this in the book. Maybe I did. But, you know, my first trial, my secret prayer to myself was, I don't care if I win or lose, just please make it so I look like a real lawyer. Please don't let me embarrass myself. And that was my feeling for at least the first 5 years of trying cases. Like, I want to look like a real lawyer, not embarrass myself. Well, how much energy was I putting into, quote, not embarrassing myself? And how much better if that energy could have been channeled towards making out my case? So, yeah, I mean, there's not an easy answer to your question. Like, how do you walk that line between showing too little or too much emotion? But I think the real question and the starting point is, how do you get to the point where a well-adjusted person can make that judgment in the first place. Like if you're terrified of getting embarrassed in front of the jury, or if the judge, the authoritative judge, is pushing your buttons and you're getting angry every 10 minutes, you know, you're in your own personal struggle. You're not even in the courtroom. I mean, you are, of course, but a big piece of you is not even in that courtroom attending to business. It's preoccupied with all this other stuff going on inside you. So you got to clear that out. Well, you don't have to, but in terms of the things we're talking about, that's the first step, I think.
And that goes along with this idea of fear. You talk about some in the book dealing with fear. Fear can be the fear of losing. And in the case of doing plaintiff's work, which I happen to do also, when you lose, it stacks up on itself, because you not only lose the trial, but you also don't recover any fees. So therefore, you lose money.
And you lose your cost money.
And in theory, you could lose your house, or you could lose your family, or, you know, whatever else is depending on you, you know, generating income for yourself. And you talk a little bit about this hungry ghosts concept, which I'd be interested in hearing more about. But just back to the issue of fear, because I do think fear, I mean, for lawyers who never set foot in a courtroom to even begin with, one reason they don't is because of fear. And then for lawyers who do set foot in a courtroom, a lot of their behaviors are probably dictated on some level by fear. Fear of performance anxiety, fear of loss, fear of looking like an idiot or embarrassing yourself with the jury or with the judge, et cetera. And you had some really great insights about fear in your book. One of the things that resonated with me the most was a comment you made that on some level, fear is arrogance and egoism, because really what fear is saying is that I, as the lawyer, are so important that how I conduct myself really matters that much. And the more you do these cases, what you realize is, in many instances, the jury really doesn't care that much about you. That's just a great insight, I thought. But could you just talk a little bit more about how you've managed to deal with and overcome fear? And I guess what goes along with fear is stress.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the paradox, which I do point out in the book, I think, is in a way, you are the most important person in the courtroom, and you are the least important person in the courtroom simultaneously. But the most important part is this ethos thing we're talking about. The jury is evaluating us on, and you know, for lawyers who don't go into court, the same is true in any kind of professional interaction that we're, you know, our audience is evaluating us in terms of how much can I trust this person? How credible are they? You know, how solid are they as a person? So that when they tell me, you know, the whatever the fact is, when they tell me that fact, how much do I have to do due diligence and skeptically look at that? And how much can I just accept that? I can trust that they're telling me the truth, and this is, and that the whole case is truthful and honest. So there's that aspect to it. So I break down. I mean, I'm actually, there are two chapters I'm proudest of in that book, and that's one of them, because I think fear's a complicated thing, and it involves a lot of issues, different issues for different people. But I think the aspect of fear you were talking about, which is, you know, I've got a certain personality, I've got a certain image I want to project in the courtroom. You know, for me, I want to be Spencer Tracy combined with Jerry Spence, combined with Clarence Darrow. You know, I want to be a mixture of those and just totally rock the whole courtroom scene every moment that I'm there. Well, nobody can do that, including the people I just named. You know, you look at any transcript of whoever your hero lawyer is, and, you know, they're mostly trudging along a question at a time, sometimes losing their train of thought, et cetera. And so nobody can match the ideal that's in their own mind for what they want to project. Well, until you accept that you're not going to match that or even come close, you're putting energy into projecting this image. And of course, the jury can tell you're trying to project an image. So what would it be like if the jury really saw me as who I am? You know, warts and all, what would that be like? Well, it'd be scary. It'd be uncomfortable at first. But after a while, it's very freeing. And what sort of dawned on me 5 years or so in is that the jurors don't care what kind of tie I wear or what my shoes look like. And, you know, every lawyer has a story about, you know, like for me, a juror came up to me and said, "You did a great job, but you really should iron your shirts." You know, okay, but I won the case and the shirt had nothing to do. And so we all have comments from jurors that we take to heart, but those are not outcome determinative comments. Ordinarily, you know, it's they're bored, they're looking around, they see something like my shirt's not ironed right. So the things that we obsess about, I want to be smooth, I want to be in command, I want, you know, to be charismatic, entertaining, the jurors don't really care that much about that. If you're so in love with your own image, then you're advocating for your image at the same time you're advocating for your case. And it's going to be less effective than if you can let go of whatever image you're trying to project and just advocate for your case. I mean, that's the point I was trying to make in that part of the chapter, I think.
Is there any circumstance in which you think having fear is okay?
Well, we all have fear, and I think it is okay. It can be energizing. But what I would say, and I don't know if I wrote it this way, but the trick is to have right-sized fear, right? Like for me, for the first 25 years of my practice, every trial felt like a life or death struggle. Like I literally felt like I'm just going to die if I lose this case. Well, that's not right-sized fear. And in fact, if every time you go into court, it feels like a life or death struggle, you're not going to be able to go into court that much. You know, you're going to find excuses not to go. Or if you keep going, you're going to burn yourself out because we weren't meant to repeatedly experience life or death stress. So fear can be good, it energizes us, but you know, the social science studies have shown over and over again, we make worse decisions, worse judgments when we're in fear than when we're not. Doesn't mean those judgments are wrong necessarily, but like we're not at our best when we're operating from a place of fear, other than like my child's pinned under a car and I need to lift the car up, you know, those kind of things. Sure, fear can help, but in the courtroom, to be nervous, to be worried, but really, what do lawyers have to fear from going into the courtroom other than issues related to their own egos, their own histories? Or as Ben says, you know, we could lose the cost money and the time we put in, but, you know, somewhere in the book, I say, I strongly believe no lawyer should ever take a case they can't afford to lose because you're putting extra stress and fear on yourself that doesn't belong there, that's going to interfere with your representation of the client. Fear has a place, but it ought to, you know, I am afraid I'm going to lose this case and my client won't get the medical care she deserves as a paraplegic. You know, it will suck if I don't win this case. And I'm afraid that I won't. But, you know, I didn't put her in a wheelchair. It's my job to try to improve her life, given that she's now in a wheelchair. And there are a lot of forces outside my control as to whether we'll win this case or not. So me being a, you know, the example in the book was, you know, if you're waiting for surgery, and the surgeon comes in the night before and says, "How you doing, Raul?" And you say fine, but I don't know about you, doc. You look kind of nervous. What's going on? And the surgeon says, "Well, I just care so much about you, Raul. I'm just afraid something will go wrong tomorrow." That's not reassuring. That's not the surgeon you want. You want the surgeon who says, "I've got this. You know I've got to pay attention. Things could go wrong. You could get hurt. But I've been down this road. I've been trained to go down this road, and I got this." You know, and as a new lawyer, like if you're going into the courtroom for the first time, you're going to have reasonable fears of, did I prepare enough? What's the other side going to do? Am I going to lose my voice? You know, whatever your fear is, there's going to be legitimate performance fears in the early years, but they ought to be right sized. You know, okay, if I spill my glass of water on the table all over my papers, the world is not going to come to an end. If I forget to pull up my fly, the world is not going to come to an end. If I miss an objection, et cetera, et cetera. So what I think actually happens for most people is that their real fears are based in things, they're personality based, not objectively present time based, you know, here I am in this courtroom with this herniated disc case. Why am I so torqued out and unable to sleep and, you know, on and on and on? That's not an objectively based present time fear. That is a fear that has its roots deeply in the past and is controlling you and pulling your strings now. And unless you come to terms with those kinds of things, you can't be the best lawyer you otherwise could be.
So let's say you are successful in getting your internal house in order in the ways you've discussed and getting a, you know, handle on your emotional connectedness and, you know, anger issues and fear, and develop some kind of moral clarity about what the principle is that you're fighting for and why you're doing this job, you know, going into the courtroom to try this case. You next talk in your book about sort of marshaling the moral forces within the trial, identifying the moral issues that are going to be outcome determinative and that are going to resonate with the audience. And I suppose that can be a jury trial, or it could just be persuasive activities outside of a courtroom in a boardroom or somewhere else. But can you talk a little bit about that? How do you go from, you know, so you've developed an ethos for yourself, but then trying to marshal those moral forces towards getting the result you're looking for, wherever that happens to be?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of times, and this is one of the reasons I wrote the book, is I think as plaintiff lawyers, and to some extent, in some cases, in criminal defense lawyers, we often have arguments available to us or ways of framing the case available to us that we overlook. So, for example, in a bad back case, you know, somebody gets three herniated discs from a traffic accident, admitted liability. What's really going on in that courtroom is a clash of values. You know, we think of it as, I want to get money for the harms. I want to compensate this person for the harms that happened, their sleepless nights, their inability to go fishing with their son on Saturday mornings. I want to get compensation for those things. But there's a deeper level of conflict going on because, as you know, on the other side of the equation, the defense lawyers representing, in essence, corporate values. So the way I think of it is they're representing corporate values. We're representing human values. So from a corporate perspective, so our client says, for example, I argue on behalf of this client, he can't sleep well anymore. And the defense lawyer, the corporate lawyer, corporate values lawyer says, well, you know, you still have your job, so you haven't really lost any money. So your sleepless nights don't really amount to much. You know, you can still do all the things you used to do. And then I say, well, he can't fish anymore in the Saturday mornings like he used to with his son because he can't lift the boat, et cetera. And the defense lawyer comes in and says, well, you still have your job. You haven't lost any money. In fact, we're saving you money because you don't have to rent a boat anymore. And, you know, so it's really a clash of values. And I mean, every case is different, obviously, but part of what's involved is scraping away the surface and evaluating what's really at issue here. Because the jurors are humans. They should side with human values. But on the other hand, they live in a corporate values world, which is the United States of America, where corporate values have become almost a religion. So there's this real conflict. But I think as plaintiff lawyers and criminal defense lawyers, we are in a position to remind them, you know, there are things more important. I mean, the paradox and the irony is we're reminding them there are things more important than money. So give our client money for those things. So that it sounds a little weird, but that's part of so how you do it, I think, involves thought, like really spending time thinking about your case. You know, not the pace of law practice has gotten so quick that it's hard to find time to just gently think about your case. But I think having the time to really sit, and that's why the second half of the book is examples, you know, of, okay, here's the situation, here's the moral, here's how you might frame it in a way that morally reveals what the real fight is about. Because I think if you can do that, most of the time, the human jurors will resonate with and want to be attracted to the human value rather than the corporate value. But it's there's work to be done there for sure. I'm not answering your question very specifically just because there's no one single answer to that question. So I'll give one example from the book. We've got a burglary conviction. It's admitted liability for our herniated disc client, but he has a burglary conviction and it's going to be admitted because it was recent enough that it gets admitted. And so what is really going on in that case? Why didn't they settle with you, your admitted liability case? Probably because they saw the burglary conviction and they figure the jury will see that and not see anything else and come in with a very low verdict. Well, why not talk about that with the jury? You know, why not say, we're here because my client has a burglary conviction. He served his time, paid his debt to society, but they're hoping you'll ignore all the injury that was done to him and only see the burglary conviction. That's scraping away below the surface at what's really going on. And it's a skill. It takes time to sort of pay attention and be interested in discovering what that underlying moral tension or conflict is. Because the defense is saying, don't give him the kind of money you'd give to someone else because he had a burglary conviction. And you're saying, he paid his debt to society. He's a good person. He's got a good job. He's got two kids now, and he's going to live the rest of his life in pain. He shouldn't be punished again for his burglary conviction by getting an inadequate verdict. So underneath almost any of the problems plaintiff lawyers have with their cases is some kind of moral issue like that. And if you can frame it in human terms, almost all of them you can turn to advantage.
So we're almost to the end of the hour, but to maybe end on what would be a positive and optimistic note, one of the last chapters of your book describes this concept of the dancing sculptor, which I actually thought was quite imaginative and interesting.
Kind of weird. I almost didn't put that in.
You must have been a hippie back in the old
days. I wanted to be, but I wasn't.
So what is this idea? And what is it kind of, what is the, that reflect in terms of what your vision is for what you can hope to accomplish as a lawyer?
But well, if our jobs are to maximize our economic return and we have this kind of narrow crimped view of our lives, it's not that much fun what we do. But if we go to work every day advocating on behalf of values we really believe in, what a blast, what a privilege to be able to do that. And if I'm not hanging on by my fingernails to the side of a cliff trying to save my ego from getting bruised, but instead am advocating on behalf of things that are bigger and more important than me, even bigger and more important than my client, then what a joy. What a, you know, evil's never going to, evil and badness and pain and suffering are never going to disappear from the world. But how great that we can go into court and stand up for, you know, express what's inside ourselves. The best that's in us is going to come into this courtroom and shine on everybody and show them all there are things more important. You know, it's all about the meaning of life. I'm going to shine the meaning of life as best I understand it in this courtroom. And some people may get it, some people may not. I may win, I may lose. But how much better to have been the lawyer, for example, in the Dred Scott case, who advocated for Dred Scott, than to be the one on the other side? Well, the guy on the other side won the case. But, you know, who would want to go back and switch places with him? So what I'm trying to convey in the end of the book is, if you can get your own house in order, your own personal psychological house in order, and if you can hitch yourself and train yourself to perceive these bigger values issues and moral issues, it is like dancing. It is like you're creating your own self in the process. You know, who you're the messenger is changing over time. as the messenger begins to understand more and more that it's not about him or her, it's about something bigger. It can almost be a spiritual experience. So that's what I'm trying to get across there.
Well, from my perspective, you did an amazing job communicating that. I really came away from that book feeling inspired, wanting to rededicate myself to many of the things you've identified in the book. And I hopefully will make me a better lawyer, and everybody who reads it will improve from and benefit from it. And for those who are listening who want to get a copy of the book, it can be found at Trial Guides. It's published by Trial Guides. Trial Guides has a website. You can order the book directly, and there'll be a link to the book in the show notes on our website at Elevate, ELAWVATE.net. So thank you so much, Rick. This has been really a pleasure and terrific hour. I wish it could continue, but...
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed it. Thank you both.
No, thank you, Rick. And just one comment also is thank you for taking all of the time to share with the legal community your insight. I mean, you come from a place of obviously great intellect, but also institutional knowledge, and your generosity in sharing it with everyone is fantastic. And one quick story is when Rick found out that I actually teach at my old law school, Trial Advocacy, he reached out to me. And he sent me 80 copies of his book on becoming a trial lawyer so I could give it to my students so that they could learn and get inspired to become trial lawyers. And it's that type of generosity that never goes unnoticed. So I really do appreciate you taking the time today and always.
Thanks for listening to our first episode of the Elevate Podcast. We hope you'll subscribe and come back to hear us in 2 weeks for our second episode. If you're interested in ordering Rick's book and you use the promotion code RF, that's for Rick Friedman, CLE, RFCLE, you'll get an extra 10% off Rick's book. Thanks again and see you in 2 weeks.
For more information about today's guest and the topics discussed on this show, please visit our website at www.elevate.com. That's ELAWVATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes. And you can sign up to be on our email list and continue the conversation in our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope you'll subscribe and consider giving us an excellent review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your own practices and lives. And we will see you again in 2 weeks for our next episode.